All right. Well, thanks for coming. I know Saturday can be exhausting, right? Because we've been in so many things up until now. But yeah, as Katie mentioned, I spent last fall doing a sabbatical with World Relief. I had had international experience, worked overseas, started teaching 10 years ago, 11 years ago, actually, and was interested in getting more experience working with international populations locally, once I finished my doctorate and had a little more time maybe to do something. And one thing led to another to doing a sabbatical. There's a lot of refugee resettlement in Akron, Ohio, which is where I live. I work about a half an hour away in Canton from there. And so got connected with World Relief Akron, who was starting resettlement. There's another organization that's been doing immigration work for 100 years in the area and has a long history of refugee work. So there were already a lot of refugees in our area. And so I was talking to the director of World Relief Akron about what, they'd be interested in for a sabbatical, and that led to this study. So she just, said, I'm really interested in trying to make sure we are not recreating refugee camps in Akron, Ohio, because there had been some people talking and wondering, like, what's happening? Are we doing this well? Are we empowering? She understood the community development model, CCDA, Christian Community Development Association model, and now they are actually a CCDA affiliate. And then part of my research has been related to anti-oppressive practice. So we kind of talked about all these things and the overlap, and we're trying to figure out how to do a study on using qualitative methodology to ask people working with refugees and, as we like to say, former refugees, people who have resettled, about their perspectives on refugee resettlement. And that led to this study, which has spent the last year working on it and still, working on some, new information and data from it. But this is sort of where we're at with what I've learned so far. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about understanding what is refugee resettlement. I think a lot of people hear a lot on the news, but don't fully understand. Sorry, thank you. Don't fully understand who refugees are compared to general immigrants that come here. And then we'll talk a little bit about that, and then about our Christian faith values and how they intersect, and then think about the qualitative methodology that I used. And hopefully, most of our time, I'll actually be sharing the results of the study, but go through some introductory things first. So, what is a refugee? Does everybody know what a refugee is in here? Do you have an idea? Okay. So an official definition is a refugee is someone who has been forced to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. A refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Most likely, they cannot return home or are afraid to do so. War and ethnic, tribal, and religious violence are leading causes of refugees fleeing their countries. Yeah.
Am I correct that economics is not a qualification of refugee status?
Correct, right. So we do sometimes use the term that people are coming as economic refugees, and there certainly are people that come here. But when we think about the actual legal term for refugees, so when we hear about people being resettled here as refugees, they have to come under this definition and come through an official policy, which I'm going to skip ahead just since you asked that question. This is, and you'll be able to see this better if you have the drive, the flash drive with the information. But there's an official resettlement process that happens here. So when we're talking about refugees, it's important to recognize we're not talking about people who've come here to flee, yeah, like you said, economic issues, and they're very real. Some people are coming here for very real economic reasons, and there's obviously an overlap sometimes, between the actual definition. But people have to go through a process, a vetting process, to come here as refugees, and then they are helped in that resettlement process. It's usually a 90-day process. So this just, I'm not going to go through all the details of this, but they are resettled through the United Nations and then the Department of Homeland Security here, and then linked with a VOLEG, a volunteer agency, basically, which is that second column. And there's 9 of them in the United States, in lots of different cities. World Relief happens to be one of them. Majority of them are actually faith-based, although they're not all. And so they come here, are resettled through an agency, and then that agency works with them for a minimum of 90 days. Most of them have just 90-day funding. So in the first week, usually within the first 2 days, they're getting their Social Security number, they're getting an ID, getting set up and linked with job opportunities and all of that. They're given housing. They're even required to have a culturally appropriate meal when they arrive. So there's strict requirements to help people resettle. Doesn't mean the process is perfect, but there's a process there. But before they even get here, there's a very strict vetting process that takes place. And usually it's 6 months to 3 years. A lot of people you hear say have said 2 years. I've known people that have gone through it for 3 years that I talk to, especially from countries like the Middle East where people are more concerned about security issues. So, yeah, so that's the process. And there are, as it says on the right, there's some funding for longer support beyond that 90 days, but most of the people in our area only receive that 90 days of support. And then they can be eligible just like a typical U.S. citizen for social services that we would be eligible for, but not anything more or less than that. And then they can go through the process of becoming citizens. You know, they're being set up for that process, granted that Social Security card right away. All of that is happening for them in that process. They don't have to apply for that with any special, given refugee status gives them the status to get that Social Security card, because a lot of people kind of wonder about that. Some people are questioning, you know, are refugees undocumented? No, they're very documented, extremely documented, actually, in that whole process. Just to, you know, define and distinguish terms, I thought I'd start with that, because not everybody knows, and we hear this term being thrown around quite a bit, you know. So, all right, so really just thinking about what's been going on, right? We've been hearing about immigrants and refugees a lot lately, haven't we, in the news? And so just some background to this is just, and this might be obvious, but just to present, we're kind of in a place where we have a lot of people that are fearful. They're concerned. Who are these people that are entering our country? We have people questioning legal concerns, policy concerns, suggesting that we need a vetting process, which actually is in place. I'm not saying it doesn't need some work. We should always reevaluate how we're doing things, but we do have a vetting process that is pretty strict. People have economic concerns, you know, are these people taking away resources from people that are already in our country, things like that. And then just this idea of, are we offering a welcoming environment here? You know, many of us that do believe that we are to welcome people, are we? Or are we having, you know, or are we developing to more of an isolationist country? You know, we're going to, you know, close our borders and not welcome people as much. So, but then in doing research on refugee resettlement, as I've already said, there's a very rigorous vetting process, a long process for doing this. I mentioned the 90-day process already of how people get support when they first arrive. And then there are a lot of studies that have shown the economic benefit of resettlement. In the area I live in, Northeast Ohio, the Cleveland area and Akron both have had pretty detailed economic studies, not just on immigrants in general, but specifically refugees, and how much their investment is going back into the community. And in particularly places that have had a lot of displacement, the populations have gone down due to the economy, immigrants and refugees coming into those areas really have benefited the country. And an example, because one of the things that people are concerned about is how much money are we putting into this, right? Because of this 90 days of potential support, although once people are working, they're not getting that financial support. But because just like us, you know, the more money we make, the less that we can get of that. But for example, in 2013, about $2.8 million was put into refugee resettlement in Cleveland. It sounds like a lot, right? $2.8 million, that's a lot. But the study showed that the return on the investment with former refugees paying taxes, buying homes, starting businesses, because immigrants, including refugees, are almost twice as likely to start businesses than native-born people. So the return on the investment just in that 1 year was $28 million. So that's a pretty big return, and those people are typically staying, right? So every year that return continues. So that just gives you an idea that, you know, that some of these myths need to be debunked, you know. And then, you know, those of us who look at, interpret scripture with thinking about immigration and refugee resettlement, there's a lot of evidence to show that as Christians, it's part of our calling to welcome immigrants, welcome refugees. For example, you know, in Leviticus 19:33, it says, "A stranger who resides among you, do him no harm. Treat them as one of your citizens. Love him as yourself." That's just, there's many scriptures. I'm just going to throw out a couple. Matthew 25:35, we're familiar with that passage about, you know, to welcome, as we welcome strangers, we're welcoming Jesus. Just as examples, I'm thinking about even Jesus and his family, they were political refugees. They had to leave, you know, they left the area to save Jesus's life, you know, because of a policy, right, that was putting people's lives in danger that were the age of Jesus, right, because of Herod being threatened, you know. So there's, you know, scriptural evidence, you know, for welcoming foreigners, loving them as ourself, loving our neighbor as ourself, right? So there's all that, there's this evidence, but there's clearly been conflicts, right, within the church. And I've definitely had some experiences where I've had people that were just really, really angry that I was in support of refugee resettlement because of their legitimate fear, genuine fear that they were concerned that people were going to hurt us here. And so just as I introduced this study, I just wanted to share some of that, some of the basics of, like, this is kind of where we've been at, you know, in our society. And there's some legitimate concerns, but there's a lot of evidence that goes against those concerns. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with everything that you're saying. Mm-hmm. Play the devil's advocate.
Sure.
Are mm-hmm. you aware of any numbers of refugees who have come in through this rigorous vetting program who have then gone on to commit terroristic acts?
No. And there's, you know, we definitely have had people commit terrorist acts. So there's a concern, right, that there's people that are, you know, coming from other places or being trained in the Middle East. But typically they're coming through other ways, you know, through a marriage visa or a student visa or other experiences, but not through that refugee resettlement process.
I'm going to make the hypothesis that the ones that I see, Boston bombers, etc., mm-hmm. are children of second generation
right.
that, immigrants yep. and refugees, mm-hmm. and the failure to integrate and to mm-hmm. be properly welcome may be the biggest risk factor.
Could be. Us. Yeah, it's a good observation.
All, just a,
yeah.
a hypothesis.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair enough. Yeah, so, yes, go ahead.
I'm like 99.9% certain that none of them have been children of refugees. There's been zero terrorists.
Yeah, but children of immigrants, right?
The Boston bombers, I think, were children of asylees, which...
Yeah, and that's a good point. So, you know, asylees are, and that's a definition we didn't talk about, but they are people that come here and get here through, sometimes it's a tourist visa, sometimes it's, you know, through various reasons, but then they meet the definition of refugee status and receive it once they're here.
Right.
So that's another, right, yeah. And so they're already here, and then they meet that definition, typically because they're from one of the countries that if they would have applied over there, they would have been granted that status as well. So that's another one of those terms that sometimes we don't fully understand what that means. So any other questions, comments as we continue? All right, thanks for sharing your thoughts. All right, so we went through that. So now we're going to talk about the research study itself. Okay, so I did qualitative interviews. They were approximately 1 hour. I had 26 participants, but 20 interviews. So some of them, sometimes I interviewed two people together. And if they were together, they were people that worked together in refugee resettlement, or they were people that were from the same country and came as refugees and knew each other. I didn't put random people together. It was like, for example, two business owners that are partners in the area, and I interviewed them together, you know. And that was interesting because they knew each other, you know, much longer than I had known them, and played off each other and support. Sometimes they were family members as well. So 19 of the people I interviewed were working in refugee resettlement. 13 of the people were born outside of the United States, so came as immigrants of some sort. 9 specifically had come as refugees. So it's about 50-50 immigrants versus people non-immigrants. Some of those immigrants or former refugees were working in resettlement themselves. Some were not. So tried to get a variety of perspectives. And when I share quotes, you'll see that many of the quotes, you'll know the situation of them by their quotes, really. Okay, so transcribed, coded for themes. I used Atlas TI software, which is a qualitative program that, thanks to Malone, I have access to. So if you don't have that through a university, it's a very expensive program, so I'm very thankful for that. And then analyze the results based on what they said. So I always make that clear, especially if I'm not talking to researchers, like, these quotes, these results are the participants' perspectives, not based on my opinion, not based on, you know, just general conversations, but what people actually said in the research. Yeah.
Do you know what nation are most of these people?
Oh, yeah, I don't have that on here just because of the time. But, yeah, so many of them, that's a good question, were from, in our area, we have a lot of Nepali Bhutanese people. So I had many from there. I had 3 that were from the Middle East, different countries, Syria and Iraq, were actually the 2 countries they were from. 1 from Vietnam, so he had been here longer, and so had, you know, like 20 years to talk about, you know, his process. I'm trying to think. Those were the main areas that they were from. And then the immigrants I interviewed were all actually from Asia or Southeast Asia. So, yeah, I was trying to get people from more variety of places, but you have to find people that are open and willing. I was trying to get some Congolese people, but it was hard because I was trying to be really sensitive to how long they had been here. And some of the former refugees get asked to do so much when they have those charismatic personalities. And I was meeting some people and asking and just sensing, yeah, maybe this just isn't right. So trying to be an ethical social worker and in that whole process of, you know, not imposing myself too much on people, even though I was trying to get as much diversity as possible. Yeah. All right. So I asked a variety of questions. One of the questions I asked was, what does it look like for a refugee to be empowered? So these were the most common things. And this is everyone together, aggregate data at this point. I haven't actually separated it yet. So this is people that are working day in and day out in resettlement, some as paid workers, some as very, very dedicated volunteers. Like, one of the guys is a retired assistant provost from a state university who spends all his time working with refugees in his retirement. You know, so there's some people like that, and as well as people that are working within refugee resettlement agencies or organizations that work in general immigration, just in, like, nonprofits that work with immigrants of all kinds, but asking them specifically about refugees. So the first one was language skills. That's pretty obvious, right? This is what people were saying. So language skills and financial security were at the top. And the next one was civic engagement and leadership. So those are the things people were saying. You know, we think that these are important for people to feel empowered. Then the next one, and this did come up quite a bit, was helping other refugees. So it's not just about basic needs, according to people working with refugees and refugees themselves. They want to be independent, as the next one says, but they also want to be able to give back. But then there was other practical things, like, you don't have to know everything. I don't know how to do everything in my community, but helping to know how to navigate the system. So having people that can help them figure that out, knowing how to ask the right questions. And having education was another one. And having relationships within and outside the community. And that was interesting because I had done research on the impact of semester abroad students, social work students, and how that has affected them when they came back. And the same outcome came out of that, this importance of having relationships within the local culture to help you navigate the system. And then some people from your own culture that you can vent to, that you can eat your own food with, they know what you're talking about. But it's really important, and a lot of former refugees said it, that if we just stay with people from our own culture, and that was that recreating the refugee camp idea, then we're not benefiting from the relationships of people who live here. We're not knowing how to navigate the systems. We're not knowing how to start a business and know what to sign, what not to sign for loans, and people getting themselves in bad deals, you know, things like that. So those relationships were important. So have that oasis, you know, of people like you that you can talk with, you know, two of these guys had opened a Nepali restaurant in the area. And, you know, it's just, you know, wonderful that they have that for their own community and for us to enjoy their culture. But they were like, we can't just stay here. We have to step out. And this was very consistent, you know, amongst people working with refugees as well as refugees themselves. You have to be in both worlds. That integration is extremely important, you know, not to become all American, right? Not to lose your culture, but also to have people that you can help interpret the culture for you and advocate for you and help you get a job in your field when you're shredding paper, but you're, you know, an amazing businessman, you know, with all this experience. You just don't know the language yet, so it's hard to get through there, you know, get to that process.